from Cape Town, this is the voice of the Cape, 91.3 FM.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to this week's edition of The Burning Issue. I'm your host, Yazid Kamaldin. Now, the killing of 16-year-old Nathaniel Julies outside his home in El Dorado Park, Johannesburg on August 26th, allegedly by a police officer, has provoked nationwide anger and condemnation. Not only was this teenager unarmed, he also had Down syndrome. The South African Police Service says Nathaniel was killed during a confrontation between police officers and gang members. But eyewitnesses have a different account and say the boy had gone to a shop to buy food and that there was no gang shooting or violent activity at the time he was shot. A male and female police officer appeared in court yesterday and now face charges of premeditated murder, defeating the ends of justice, discharging a firearm in a public space, and unlawful possession of ammunition. Whether they will be brought to book, we will have to wait and see. But Nathaniel's senseless death has again placed police brutality in the national spotlight. A few months ago, we saw the brutal murder of Collins Khosa, who was beaten to death in his Alexandra home by South African National Defence Force members during the COVID-19 lockdown. And last month, a rubber bullet killed 9-year-old Leo Williams from St. Helena Bay. Leo was sitting inside his uncle's house watching TV when he was hit in the head as police clashed with protesters outside. And just recently, 8-year-old Clarence Solomons lost his life during a protest over a house demolition after being hit by a stray bullet of law enforcement. Now, at the weekend, we saw a gender-based violence protest in the Cape Town city centre descend into chaos when police used excessive force on protesters. Why are we seeing a rise in police brutality? Have communities lost their trust in the police? Why is achieving justice for victims of police violence difficult? And what is the interlinkage between racial injustice and police brutality towards people of color? Those are some of the burning questions we ask tonight in Burning Issue. And in the program, we hope to look at several issues, including how the Independent Police Investigations Directorate deals with cases of police brutality and misconduct. We have a number of guests joining us this evening, and I'd like to now welcome our first two guests to the show. We have Imran Mukaddam, a member of the United Public Safety Front, as well as Ghalib Khaland, Right to Know National Deputy Coordinator. Gents, good evening and welcome to Burning Issue.
Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam. Walaikum salam.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yeah, guys, by way of introduction, let's first talk about your organizations very briefly so that our listeners know exactly who you represent and what you do. Let's start with Imran. Imran, can you please tell us, what is the United Public Safety Front?
United Public Safety Front was formed 2 years ago as a coordinating structure for non-governmental organizations and structures, neighborhood watch structures and CPFs, to have an alternate voice outside of the normal channels and to be a coordinating structure that can look at the issues of public safety on a much broader scale, especially in the Western Cape at the moment.
Thank you. And Ghalib, can you please tell us very briefly what is Right to Know?
So the Right to Know campaign has been around for, it's our 10th year this year, one of our focus areas is on countering repression and securitization, specifically related to surveillance by the state and private actors, and then on the right to protest. Opening up space for people's voices to be heard. So we're very concerned about certainly coming out of the Zuma years and even continuing into the last 2 or 3 years, The increasing repressive stance by our, particularly the security forces in South Africa.
Okay. So, Ghalib, now obviously that means that you guys have been monitoring police activity, especially around force. Give us an idea of what exactly is going on. I've mentioned at the introduction of the program a list of murders, alleged killings. People have died at the hands of police brutality. What is the situation like from your perspective? It's right to know.
So, I think this is a really complex issue, just to say that up front. Each of the situations that you mentioned also had their own dynamics in them. So it's hard to extrapolate draw a common cause, right? Except to say that probably we're dealing with a legacy of a really untransformed police service. So many of the apartheid-era police officers are now relatively senior. And so when you look at what happened at St. Helena Bay, and the police actions there, it really was a throwback to how they've been operating even in the last 20 years, dating back to before Democracy 94. So you still have remnants of that in the police force, and the sense of a police force rather than service. So that's, I think, one aspect. So ill-trained police officers or police officers that ignore, for example, the national instruction on crowd control and dealing with protest actions. So drawing your sidearm is not allowed, for one, mm-hmm. for example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, of course, we've had also all of the cases that you mentioned have the additional complication of the COVID-19 national lockdown regulations, which has also made illegal, essentially, or unlawful at least, public protest actions. So what that has meant is that the protections that are there, slim as they are in the Regulation of Gatherings Act, for example, don't apply. And so what we saw at Parliament, for example, was police stepping in quite quickly to disperse what they considered an illegal gathering, because the mechanisms for making that a legal peaceful protest just aren't in place because of the regulatory framework.
Thanks, Ghalib.
So you're dealing with a number of different factors.
Yeah, thank you. So, Imran, I really am trying to understand the police activity, right? So what do you think is at the root of the problem, Imran?
Well, I think, as Ghalib says, there's a lot of contributory factors, and it's very complex to try and unravel exactly what is the root cause of police violence. And not only police, we're seeing a lot of violence on the part of law enforcement. We're seeing the outsourcing of law enforcement to private security companies. That's also being quite violent with, especially evictions. So yes, we're dealing with a very violent and repressive policing framework. And I think it's really doing a lot of damage to our democracy and to our understanding of the trust relationship between police and communities. Now, at community level, this breaks down every effort by communities to build community structures such as neighborhood watches and CPFs and so forth. So we're finding, especially in that space, it's very difficult to work with police because there's just too much fragmentation of the different units that is able to respond to, for instance, a protest scene. There would be law enforcement, there'd be public order police, there'd be the local police, there'd be traffic and other, and nobody is able to handle a protest situation effectively because there's too many structures with no real center of command. So this is in protest situations, it's impossible for those responding to the protest to be well coordinated. If there's so many responding and the people on the ground and the local police aren't given an opportunity to negotiate first. And we saw this in the range and Epping Forest last week where young Clarence Solomons was killed. There was absolutely no negotiation. There was no opportunity given to try and restore calm when the community became violent,
mm-hmm.
and or even just protesting and burning tires. And police started shooting without warning, without a process. And obviously, in a gang-infested, crime-infested area, such as the range, where we know there's a proliferation of firearms, and which is a gang stronghold, where retaliation from the gangs themselves.
Yeah.
And what this does is it sort of gives the gangs the authority to run a parallel state within our communities. So one of the things that we're concerned with as the United Public Safety Front is specifically the failure of the state to win over the trust of communities through the repressive and violent response to crime and civil protest.
Okay. Look, I mean, I think what we also need to understand is that the attitude of the police seems to be shoot to kill. I mean, I now want to recall a 2009 statement by Minister Bheki Tele, who said that, you know, police officers, he actually instructed police officers to shoot to kill and quote unquote worry later. I mean, do you think that is the prevailing attitude in the police force? Either guest can answer.
So maybe if I just step in there. I think that attitude does pervade the SAPs. And so certainly one of the things that we've been calling for is the demilitarization of SAPs. So you'll be aware that in SAPs at the moment, you've got a ranking order that really follows a military rank. In the early days of democracy, we moved away from that. It was much more what Imran is talking about, community policing forums and community policing, so that police stations became community centers, service centers. But I think we've lost that. So we've got a krachtdadige approach from particularly the top brass in SAPS. The minister particularly is very vocal and cowboyish. But also don't forget that even when the SANDF generals appeared before Parliament, they also exhibited the same kind of attitude. When we had Collins Khoza being shot and killed inside his property, that was also SANDF, again with their command and control structure, not understanding their policing function. And treating civilians in that case as belligerent. And so that militarized thinking is what I think we see on the ground. And so protesters are seen as belligerents in the first instance. There's a demonization of protest and the criminalization of protest, particularly in the last 6 months or so under the COVID-19 regulations also.
Mm-hmm. Imran, what do you think about this idea of the shoot to kill?
Well, under Bheki Tele, basically when he was Commissioner of Police and now when he's Minister of Police, he has come in with this gung-ho approach and he reinforces that within the top structure and within police junior structures. There is this sort of thinking that there's no consequence for the actions. And you see the consequences of that is the, with the militarization also goes the cooperation of the community, and you see communities becoming very much opposed to the police instead of working together with the police. We find that in our structures, for instance, Mohalib has mentioned COVID. One of the first things that Minister Bheki Tele said was that CPFs and neighborhood structures are non-essential functions. And we were left out in the cold for the first 2 months of the COVID when it was at its height, and we could have made the biggest difference in terms of crowd control and ensuring social distancing. And we were just left out, and we were not allowed to operate. And these are the kinds of decisions that breaks those within our communities that have the goodwill to want to make a change. It's just taken away. And then the only way to get a ear becomes protest action. And similarly with municipalities like the city of Cape Town, for instance, it's easy for the mayor to say that the community has blood on their hands. But if law enforcement and the city structures don't follow procedures and court orders and the regulations, specifically around COVID and evictions, then everybody's got blood on their hands, because we are seeing this where they just blatantly disregard any process and just go in and irrespective of what the protocols are, there's just no ways that you can stop the decisions to evict or the decisions to destroy people's homes. And in the middle of winter and in the middle of a pandemic that is having huge economic impact within the poorer communities. So our people are cold, they are hungry, and they are angry. And for that scenario, you need a sympathetic police force, you need sympathetic reinforcement,
Imran.
And you need to really be able to understand the dynamics on the ground. And there's a total disconnect.
Thank you, Imran. Thank you. We'll go for an ad break. When we come back, we'll continue with this conversation. Imran, can you please tell us a bit about your own experience of police brutality?
Yeah, we again, you know, I had a situation where I was being accused of some theft or whatever, of bread crates, which was done for competition issues and had absolutely nothing to do with your crime. But there we found a flying squad responding to a very trivial situation, and when I basically I phoned our station commander to find out if they know about this issue, and he said that I've got no authority to be in the area. And when I told this to the police officers involved, I was summarily arrested, and I was put into a car, locked in the car for 30 minutes without the windows even open, handcuffed behind my hands behind my, and up on my back. And I sort of experienced firsthand the kind of treatment that citizens, many times innocent citizens, have to endure at the hands of police officers that work outside of their jurisdiction, but also outside of a process where they can arrest you for just talking back to them and demanding them to show the identification, which in this case they did not have on them. And I was arrested, I was charged, I had to appear in court twice, all a wastage at the taxpayers' expense of something that could be resolved very easily with a phone call. So we find this also aggravates the relationship between police and citizens, and many a times law-abiding citizens that are then at the receiving end of police brutality, it changes their whole civic understanding and the role of the own role within society as those that want to make a difference. They become very antagonistic. My colleague that was with me at the time, Shaman Grebe, was assaulted and basically slapped through the face by the policeman that arrested me when she started making a video. So yes, you find these kinds of this total abuse of power. Really, it breaks down people's trust. And we as community leaders, we try very hard. Even this afternoon, I had an incident where shots were fired at a shopkeeper by gangsters for protection money. We try very hard to work very closely with the police in order to make our area safer.
Yeah.
But the biggest obstacle right now is this police, and it's not all police, there are very good policemen out there, there's very good law enforcement officers out there, and there are many that are doing a sterling job. But there's a few that follow the lead and believe that there's no consequence. And that is one of the biggest issues, is there's very often no consequence.
Imran, please give me a chance to also ask questions of Ghalib.
So no problem.
Yeah. Please keep, guys, please, let's keep the answers to the point. I appreciate all your feedback, but we also have some questions to get through. Ghalib, are you monitoring the trust that community has in the police service, and do communities still trust the police?
So what we are monitoring are the various protests in five metros, here in the city of Cape Town, eThekwini, and the three metros in Gauteng. And particularly the sort of underlying causes of the service delivery protest actions. Of course, during this COVID-19 period, we've also been looking at broader repression by security agencies. And so the net is thrown a little bit wider. What we haven't done is to survey the community's relationship with police. Imran probably would be able to speak more about that, because that's a DOCS function, a Department of Community Safety, and neighborhood watches and community police forums fall into that category. But again, we were talking about, maybe just to make one point here on the Cape Flats particularly, that the gang culture and what we saw in Elsie's River does set up a parallel security structure. And so we mustn't also forget that there's that, almost a competing enforcement mechanism that we're also dealing with in places like El Dorado Park or on the Cape Flats. And so that makes the situation even more complicated. And so people will, if poor communities can't afford private security, then often gangs play that particular role. And that then complicates matters even more.
Mm-hmm. I think what is important for us to understand as citizens is that we can take, there is a mechanism and there is a recourse. And I want to leave also our listeners with a bit of an empowerment message. So we've got the independent, we've got IPED, the Independent Police Complaints Directorate. Talk to us a bit about that. Perhaps, Ghalib, if you can tell us, what can citizens do?
So a couple of things. One, so IPED is overstretched and under-resourced. However, it is there as a oversight body that looks particularly at criminal activities by police officers. So we have a place to refer to. So that's one thing. And we need to make more use of that particular facility. And we're also campaigning for greater resourcing of that oversight function, maybe moving it out of the Minister of Police's umbrella. Yeah, in the Western Cape, though, we also have a police ombud. So we're the only province in the country that has a police ombud, and that office looks at maladministration within SAPS. Because you also mustn't forget, it's not just the violence and the direct violence that we are dealing with in SAPS. It's also, you know, the dockets that get lost, the way that people who are arrested are treated in when they are brought into a police station, in the holding cells, et cetera, et cetera. So the Office of the Police Ombud is also an important role. Can I just say one last thing just about the St. Helena Bay situation? The fact that we had monitors on the ground, we were able also to refer that particular incident to the South African Human Rights Commission, and that's now led to that particular SAPS office being suspended, operations being suspended there, big investigation into the what, how those SAPS offices have been.
So it's good to know
operating.
It's good to know that there's recourse. Citizens do not just get killed by the police. They can also, look, we understand, as you said, that unfortunately IPED is overstretched and understaffed and all those things. So people might have to wait quite long for justice. Our listeners are always very interactive in the show, and listener 3249 says, the people who issue the orders which are aimed against people of color should be held accountable along with the police officers. That's, of course, saying that the police officer who pulls the trigger should not only be held accountable, but also the persons who give those orders. Then listener 0115 says the guests should be policemen going into gang-infested areas on weekends in areas like Manenberg, etc., where police get killed on a regular basis. Police makes mistakes because they fear for their lives. Now, I think we should say that police killing someone is not making a mistake. That you can't put that down to a mistake. At least that is what I would think. I mean, if my family member had to be killed by the police and the police had to turn around and tell me that's a mistake, I certainly would say wrong. That cannot be a mistake. We are now going to go for the Ishai prayer break. Listeners, do stay tuned after Ishai for the program. Imran and Ghalib, shukran so much. Thank you for joining us this evening on Burning Issue.
Shukran for having us.
The Burning Issue. Welcome back to The Burning Issue with myself, Yazid Kamaldin. Now, before the pre-break, we spoke to two activists on the frustration being felt on the ground with regards to police brutality and the lack of will by authorities to effectively tackle this within the policing system. Now, for the next 20 minutes, I want to uncover this further by understanding the role of the Independent Police Investigative Directorate, or IPID, whose mandate it is to ensure independent oversight of the national and municipal police services. Now, I had mentioned IPA during one of the interviews, or rather during the interviews before the break. And now we're going to welcome to the show IPA spokesperson, Dileka Kola. Dileka, good evening. Welcome to Burning Issue.
Good evening, Seth, and good evening to your listeners, and thank you for having us on board.
Mm-hmm. So, Dileka, what is so important for us to understand is the role of IPA, but also the role in its, in society, where it is about ensuring that police are held accountable for their actions. Is that the role of IPED?
Indeed. The mandate of IPED is to play an oversight role over the police. So it's an independent investigative directorate that effectively and independently and impartially investigates the misconduct of the alleged misconduct of police officers, right? So we do so, and we are empowered by the IPED Act, and specifically the IPED Act, the Section 28 of the IPED Act. Then on that Section 28 is where you get all the details of what sort of matters that IPED investigates. So the first one, we investigate any death of a person that's in police custody. For example, if somebody, one of the recent cases we've had in the Mtolume matter that you had to investigate, it was a person that was in police custody, but that allegedly hanged themselves inside the police custody. We investigate such cases. That's number one. Number two, we investigate death as a result of police action. So this could be because the police officer, for example, has assaulted the person, or a police officer has shot at the person. This could be deliberate, or this could be like one of those unfortunate incidents where someone just gets shot by accident.
I'm sorry. I really just cannot understand how a police officer who is meant to be a professional shoots somebody by accident.
Listen, there are other instances where it's not a matter of negligence from the police. I'll give you an example, practical example. You've got a community that is protesting, and they're doing so, and they're over the bridge, right? And you've got a civilian that is walking down under the bridge. And then the police, in their duty, they're trying to disperse the crowd, And as they're shooting at the crowd with the intention of dispersing them, then they accidentally shoot at somebody that is just walking along their way, and they've got nothing to do with the protest. So it's incidents of that nature. Not like they were shooting at that person, it's not like they were targeting at that person. It's just a genuine accident. We've had another case. I'm giving you a second scenario. Another case we've had recently in Gauteng. A police officers were actually in the van, and they were discharging their duties, five of them in a police van. And as they were to chase the suspects, then one of the police officers that was sitting at the back accidentally shot her colleague. So that, those are kind of accidents and incidents.
I mean,
a gun
is something that you are trained to use, you know. I mean, is it a lack of training? Or what is going on? I mean, at the start of my show, I listed a number of people, especially young children, people under 18, who have recently been killed by the police. Last week, we saw Nathaniel Julius. We've heard about Clarence Solomons, an 8-year-old, 9-year-old Leo Williams. I mean, essentially, we need to understand that our police are going to be doing something about this to stop the killing, especially of vulnerable people in South Africa. Can you please tell us how does
I now deviate from the in just educating your listeners about what IP does and the mandate of IP?
I think the idea is to ensure the listeners that they can count on the police not to kill citizens.
Okay, maybe I would prefer that we finish, because people don't understand the mandate of IP, and sometimes they think we deal with service delivery matter. Do you want us maybe to hold this question and then we come back to talk?
Look, I don't think we need to list every particular case that IP would investigate, because this is a new show.
Definitely, it would take more than
exactly.
More than
so I'm trying to navigate into the news, which is people are being killed by the police. The police need to be held accountable. Tell us what IPED is doing in that regard. You told me in the break that you've just come from a case, somebody has been arrested. Tell us about what IPED is doing to ensure the police do not kill citizens.
The mandate of IPED is at the point where the police has transgressed of what is expected of them to do. We come in and investigate and find the facts around what transpired in that particular incident. So do you understand that the mandate of IP starts at the point where a police has contravened the law?
Got that. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
What's happening around the current cases? Police officers arrested, police officers being investigated, recent killings. Please tell us what's happening to police officers. Give us an update.
That's very broad. Maybe you want to...
Okay, specific cases. Nathaniel Julius.
Yes.
Leo Williams, Clarence Solomons. These are the cases that have made headlines.
Okay, with regards to Nathaniel Julius' case, IPED has this evening arrested a third suspect into this case. Last week on Friday evening, we investigated two suspects. And those two suspects appeared in court in Protea Magistrate Court in Gauteng, and they're being charged for murder. They're being charged for death as a result of police action. They're being charged for being in possession of the prohibited ammunition, as well as defeating the ends of justice. And then they appeared in court, and due to the serious nature of the charges that they are facing, then the magistrate advised them to both go and secure legal representation. So they are set to appear in court again on the 10th of September. Then with regards to the third suspect that was arrested today, he is also from the same area, which is El Dorado Park, and the charges are defeating the ends of justice, as well as being in possession of prohibited ammunition. So it's those two charges for him. He's a police detective, and he's set to appear before the court on Thursday, the 3rd of September 2020. He will also be appearing in the same court, and that's Protea Magistrate Court. So the investigation into these matters continue, and at this point in time, this is what we're just saying as IPED, that we're doing our best. The investigation is going swiftly. We've had challenges in this case because we were not informed on time, and as a result, and as well, the police that are alleged to have killed Nathaniel they took the body to the hospital, and thus the IPID could not process the scene. But the IPID has since, as a result of that, sought services of specialists, and yesterday we had them going back into the scene to reconstruct the scene, working with IP officials as part of the investigation process. Yeah.
Thank you for that update. Now, before the break, we had somebody from an organization called Right to Know, and this person said that they believe IPID is overstretched and understaffed, and that is why not enough police investigations into police are concluded. Is that accurate? Is that a factual statement by the Right to Know movement?
What I would want someone from Right to Know movement to expatiate on what they are saying in terms of saying that IPID does not finalize cases, because IPID does finalize cases. But there's one thing the communities ought to understand is that the period of investigation is determined by various factors. Those include other reports, for example, like ballistic reports that we depend on from external stakeholders. They include post-mortem reports that we also depend on health from the health department. They include cooperation by the victim, if the victim survived them, whatever incident occurred. Also on eyewitnesses, sometimes family members. So if we struggle with cooperation from them, then it delays the process. Sometimes you must remember that law enforcement officers understand the law. There's one of the statements I issued today, and that case was reported to IPD in 2009. And this gentleman has been convicted last week, only last week.
It's a long time. Because 2009 is 10 years ago.
It's a long time, because remember, he understands the system. He's a police officer, so he's going to come and with all the sort of delayed tactics. Because remember, The suspects also have rights that have got to be...
The legal process can take time, that we understand, but we just want to know, does IPID have the resources to ensure that it investigates and holds police officers accountable when they kill or do something to citizens? That is all we need to understand. Do you have enough people? Are you under-resourced? That was the statement that was made against IPID.
Well, like any other public institution, if you'd know and if you're following the trends, all public institutions do have financial constraints, and like all of them, IPID is not immune to that challenge. But within the available resources, IPID is doing its best to finalize its investigations and to ensure most of all that.
Yeah.
We focus on the quality of our investigations and ensure that we bring justice for the victims.
Look, I need to ask these questions because citizens ask these questions. And in fact, we've got an open line, a WhatsApp line and a phone line, and WhatsApp messages are coming through. For example, listener two, and this is your opportunity to speak directly to citizens and their concerns. Listener 2172, for example, says, why do we spend our tax money on training for the police officers if there are so-called accidents on duty? So they are basically the same as the gangster running on the street with guns and no training. That's a perception that a citizen has of the police. You do not need to respond to every of these questions. I'm just sharing the information with you so that you know, when you're coming in as IPID, these are the perceptions that you are dealing with. Right? Listener 3366 says, it's a good program. The IPID woman is making excuses for police killings. That's another perception. Listener 4704 says, she's trying to cover up. Listener 521, I'm just sharing it with you.
I really would not have time to sacrifice my quality time with my family to cover up. I've got nothing to hide.
Yeah.
I'm doing my job, and my job is to inform the citizens of what IPID is doing.
Yeah.
Everybody is entitled, of course, to their opinion, but people mustn't make such uninformed allegations.
And that is why we have you here, to be able to share the work of IPID with our listeners so that you can address some of the misperceptions or perceptions that people might have of IPID and the police, you know? And then the last one that I want to share is from listener 7330, saying, cops caught in Joburg in firearm license smuggling and two men based in Cape Town. So, I mean, you also do investigate when police are allegedly involved in gun smuggling, right?
Gun smuggling.
Police are selling guns or in gun smuggling and somebody needs, I mean, this is also something you would investigate, right?
Yes, and as that person that is saying that, can they come up front and can you ensure that as you also have them accountable to ensure that they report the allegations, the serious allegations they are making? Because we don't want community members that are quick to judge and say government is defending. But what is their responsibility as a community? Is to participate, to ensure justice, you understand? So if he's got all this information, can he please make sure that as a responsible citizen, he comes forth, he reports that matter, and he becomes our key witness to ensure that those people are held into justice and they're held accountable, I mean.
Okay, and how do citizens also need to be empowered via our program. So how do citizens go about laying a complaint against a police officer or reporting what they might believe to be a police officer not doing his or her job?
The easiest thing to do is to go to our website, which is www.ipid.gov.za. And then there's a form that is available on the forms there that they can download and print out and just write out the complaint and send it back to IPID via email to complaints@ipid.gov.za.
Okay, so it's all on the website. People can get that on their phone or internet, etc. I want to now welcome to the show Daniel Knutzer, and he is the editor of Viewfinder. Daniel, good evening and welcome to Burning Issue.
Hi, Yazid. Thank you for having me, and good evening to the listeners.
Have you been listening to this interview?
I have been, the last section.
Okay. What is your take on the challenges facing IPID? Now, I believe that you have done extensive research into IPID. What is your take on the challenges that have been raised here about IPID?
On my investigation in a moment, let me just say preliminarily, the fact that IPID is chronically under-resourced is not questioned by anyone. It is unable to handle the massive caseload on its active case roll at the moment. It's only got one provincial office in many offices. Sometimes it's got two. And that means that its investigators have entire provinces at their jurisdiction. Because investigative work requires responding to scenes, this puts a massive strain on the directorate. Another response to something that Ms. Tola said a moment ago is that IPID focuses on the quality of investigations. That's actually not entirely true when looking at the performance indicators by which IPID reports its performance annually to Parliament. What IPID actually reports as a success is how many cases it completes or finalizes in a year. That means, as my investigation over a year in 2018, which was published in October last year, showed, that to make these performance quotas, IPID has systemically over years and throughout the country prematurely closed and completed cases without proper investigation. And what that essentially did is it obstructed justice for victims and it allowed perpetrators and the police to escape accountability. So we've got a lot of focus on the case of Nathaniel Julies this week in particular, but I'd like to remind listeners that the South African Police Service are accused of killing on average one person a day in this country over the last 20 years, and that generally the conviction rate that is secured through IPID investigations is around 1 to 100. So the question begs, what is IPID doing currently around improving the measures by which it measures its success?
Let's ask that. Let's ask that to the IPID spokesperson.
And the second question is, what is IPID doing to improve its case management system? As experts have recommended that IPID should formalize prioritization to look at the most serious cases, to concentrate its limited resources there, and not to be pushing numbers and statistics through the case management system to tell a good story quantitatively at the end of the year.
Well, we've got IPID on the line. They can answer.
Impact.
They can answer. Ndileka, the first question would be around, you've heard the questions. What would the response be from IPID?
No, I didn't write the questions. I don't have anything to write here. You want to run the questions by me?
Okay, look, I think what's an important question is IPID prioritizing important cases? I mean,
I believe prioritizing important cases. I am not sure what the caller means.
No, there's no formal case screening or case prioritization mechanism within IPED standard procedures. And that has been a recommendation that IPED itself committed to in Parliament in February, and that is the last that we've heard of it.
Daniel, let's hear from IPED. IPED, you have Ndeleka.
Am I going to be allowed to respond?
You are allowed to respond, please do.
The caller is going to go to town and will not give me the respect that I've accorded them.
Ndeleka, you have the right to
respond.
You have the right to respond now.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. You see, now I've lost my thinking process. So you were saying, what was the allegation?
There's an allegation that IPED does not prioritize.
If he is saying we're not prioritizing cases, why is it that we've already got three suspects? How is it that we've got three suspects that are in custody as we are speaking now on the Nathaniel case? How does it happen that we have other
because of media attention
that we are able to respond to swiftly, including the one that you're talking about of Cape Town, which is for Leo Williams, which is also in advanced stages.
Now, the other question, Ndeleka,
as well as women's issues and domestic and women rape and all those other issues of vulnerable people. We are prioritizing them. There's a gentleman that is the police that within a space of 2 weeks, their investigation was finished. That apparent that allegedly raped an 8-year-old girl in Eastern Cape. He's set to appear in court on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
This was reported to IPED mid-August. So what does he mean we are not prioritizing important cases when murder and rape of women and killing of women is taking precedence? Which criteria would he have preferred IPED to use?
Ndeleka, thank you. You've answered that question. Now, here's the other thing, though, right? After months of investigation in 2019, Daniel was involved in exposing IPED for closing cases prematurely to inflate performance statistics. And that is something that he alluded to. I spoke about just before this, right? Is it correct in saying that IPED closes cases prematurely to inflate performance statistics? Is that correct?
That is not a correct allegation. And my plea with him is that if he's got cases at hand that he believes that they have been closed prematurely by IPED, Daniel knows for a fact that we have a new director, and we are actually executive director, and we actually set to have a meeting with Daniel when we actually go to Cape Town. So what he can do is that if he's progressively concerned about the issues that he's bringing forth is to meet with IPED and come with their progressive suggestions on how best this could be handled, because this is not about Daniel coming on the stage and saying IPED is not doing well, but it's about him as also adding value into the system and saying this is the resource and the information I have, these are the suggestions. Having said that, cases, there's one thing you must consider is that there are many dependencies on IPED investigations. We depend, for example, on ballistics. We have to wait. We cannot conclude the case that we are still waiting for ballistic reports. For cases that we're waiting for post-mortem reports for, we have to wait for that information.
Do you know what, Ndeleka?
With the state,
yeah.
We have to be patient with them. Over and above that, we send recommendations to SAPS for matters of that pertain to employer and employee relationship. So we depend on
we understand. We understand that there are processes.
Yeah, before you close, he must also understand that we send the report to NPA. So there's also other cases that NPA has got their own challenges in the system. So I don't want him to to not take into cognizance the context in which these are happening. So not all the cases that have not been closed actually with IPID. Others have been transferred. Others, the reports have been sent to the relevant stakeholders.
Okay. Ndeleka has said that maybe you should also make recommendations. Now, let me ask you then, what do you think needs to be done to ensure that IPID plays its role effectively as South Africa's police oversight mechanism? Tell us, in your research, what you have found are the shortcomings and what they should do to improve their job.
Let me just say at first that I think everybody supports IPED's mandate and everybody understands the challenges, both from the police externally and also from the NPA that it faces. This is not about attacking IPED. We all support IPED's mandate to hold police accountable. What we want to see is that that mandate is fulfilled to the best of IPED's capacity and ability within its available resources, which are massively constrained. This is not about what I think. This is what about what the experts at the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum made in response to my investigation and findings. And those recommendations were essentially, I've boiled them down to two things. IPED needs to relook at how it measures its performance year on year to be more impact orientated on police conduct and accountability, as opposed to the current system whereby as many as possible decision ready, what they call decision ready or concluded investigations, are tabulated and then captured as a whole number or a percentage and presented as a performance statistic to Parliament. That performance measure needs to be re-looked at because it is conducive in an environment where quality control is difficult and constrained by resources. It is conducive to fraud at the provincial offices and to the premature closure of cases, which fails complainants. The second thing that IPED should do is it should look within its available resources to formalize the most serious cases against the police. Instead of seeing each case as one number to push through for statistical performance, it needs to formally prioritize the serious rape, the serious murder, the serious torture, the serious assault, and the serious corruption allegations, so that the limited resources can be concentrated on those while at the same time doing its due diligence for less serious cases. Those are two very simple recommendations that can be taken on in policy with the political will, and hopefully that political will be present with the new executive director. I know there's a lot of optimism around Ms. Nklat Singh, and time will tell whether she will take the offer from the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum, who have offered to help consult and to see those two recommendations become policy, because it's critically important for South Africans vulnerable to criminality and murder and assault and rape and torture by the police service that IPED looks within its resources to maximize its impact on police oversight and conduct and to measure its performance to champion that impact through case prioritization. And those are just two things, but I mean, I'm sure there are many other, and I'm sure IPED would be able to speak to those.
Is something we need to understand from your side, Ndileka, is what is the conviction rate of police officers found to be guilty of police brutality? To show, because in numbers we could see or we could measure, you know, whether police officers are in fact, you know, those cases are concluded, how many have been concluded, let's say in the last year or the last 2 years, if you like, and how many have been found guilty and not guilty. Give us an insight into the outcomes of your work.
Okay, well, at this point in time, okay, before I respond to your question, can you please get your caller that has seriously made allegations of fraud? Can you please get him to just indicate if he, as a responsible person, has reported the alleged fraud he's talking about, and he's brought evidence to IPIG so that this can be brought, so that the alleged corrupt officials or that are allegedly doing fraud can be brought into book and this thing could come to an end. I'd like to establish from him that what has he done to ensure that fraud does not thrive in South Africa?
What have I done?
And then secondly, on he's speaking about the seriousness of cases, I've alluded to this, that IPED is prioritizing women's issues. That those are people that are already vulnerable. The 16-year-old boy that is from Soweto is a vulnerable person. He's a young person and he was with all the challenges that he has. As a result, that case is prioritized.
Do you have numbers?
Officer was arrested for raping a woman in Western Cape on Sunday. He was arrested.
Do you have numbers? Do you have numbers?
No, I don't have the statistical information in front of me as I'm speaking to you. But what I will tell you is that our annual report That is, I know I've had few inquiries about the statistics, and I've been telling most of the reporters that our annual report is currently going through audit process. And once it's ready for public consumption, the minister is going to give the statistics in public. And after that, we'll engage on the statistics of all the cases that IPED has investigated. It's due to the public.
Yeah. Daniel, do you have any numbers of IPED investigations that have been concluded and where police officers have been found guilty?
I beg your pardon?
I'm just asking a question for Daniel.
Just in terms of what I've done, I haven't done anything with my career in the last 2 years apart from look at police oversight and criminality. And there's 20 articles on the website that I publish. But in terms of numbers, the statistics, the data is critical to my work. And in terms of the conviction ratio, which is the number of convictions, criminal convictions pursuant to IPED investigations compared to the number of cases taken in, I can report that is around 1 in 100 IPED cases, where the vast majority of those cases relate to criminal allegations.
Only one case or one person has been found guilty, you mean?
Criminally convicted in court, yes. Disciplinary convictions are another matter. That's slightly more. It's about 4 in 100, if I'm not mistaken, 4 or 5 in 100. But yeah, that means 95, the ratio between conviction, criminal conviction, and intake of criminal allegation is about 1 to 100.
So look, let me understand something. Are you saying that 95 cases were simply dropped, not investigated? What happened to those 95 cases? One person found guilty, 4 faces disciplinary action, which means stay at home for a week, you'll still get paid. What happened to the other 95?
It's difficult to make a blanket judgment as to what happened to the other 95 cases. What I can say is that IPED is challenged by the fact that the National Prosecuting Authority and the SAPS's own disciplinary structures do not readily take up recommendations, do not readily and vigorously prosecute these cases. Remember, prosecutors and police officers often work together. They rub shoulders in court. There's a reluctance, I've heard, anecdotally, to prosecute these cases, and that the SAPS also have a reluctance to be rigorous in its own disciplinary uptake of IPED cases. That said, I don't think we can underplay the impact that under-resourcing and poor case management systems at IPED's provincial offices have in rendering dockets which are not ready for prosecution, which are perhaps prematurely completed, as indeed my investigation showed last year was happening on a large scale across the country, and that people that tried to blow the whistle on this at that time were actually quite vigorously persecuted within the organization.
Guys, we're going to have to leave it at that. Ndileka, thank you so much for making the time to speak to us. As you can hear, a number of concerns from our listeners and, of course, also Daniel. Ndileka,
thank you so much. I think the challenge I have are the serious allegations that are unfounded and that Daniel...
they've been published.
Because when he is saying he has heard that there's... He has had. I would appreciate if Daniel can say, because he's apparently a researcher, and I think the research goes to it. The researching, as far as I understand, means they were able to find some sort of evidence. And I believe that at some point, they cannot just be talking and talking and talking. They must come up with the recommendations, and they must say, this is what they have done.
Okay.
Yazid, my article was one of the most read and published impactful articles of last year. If Ms. Ndileka Tola has not read it, it's not on me. That was of a year's worth of investigation went into a long-form expose, which was published in October last year.
I think both persons have been able to present their side of this argument. So I must thank both of you for making the time to speak to us this evening on Burning Issue. Thank you, guys. Welcome back to The Burning Issue with myself, Yazid Kamaldin. We now continue with our conversation around what we have seen in recent weeks, particularly under lockdown, and that is police Police accused of killing South Africans, in particular children. We've seen that, and I've read some of that out earlier in the program when we started. We're now welcome to the show Wayne Klube, and he is the acting deputy director, it says, of the Lawyers for Human Rights. Wayne, good evening and welcome to Burning Issue.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Wayne, for our listeners who do not know what Lawyers for Human Rights is, can you please just help us understand what it is and what you do?
Yes, so we are a non-profit NGO. We have six law clinics around the country. Our mission statement is to make rights real and specifically help vulnerable communities accessing their rights. So we're lawyers. We give pro bono legal services across the country.
Uh-huh. So in terms of helping citizens, tell us what you've done in recent times, especially around police shootings of citizens.
Yes, so recently, I suppose the most recent thing we did, we were manning a hotline, providing legal services and giving legal advice during COVID, and also documenting rights violations as soon as the regulations came into effect. And what we got was more than 50 different people calling in with issues of police brutality or unlawful conduct by police. And we normally try and assist those individuals, help gathering evidence, opening dockets, whether it's with IPED, military ombudsman, interacting with the Human Rights Commission to advocate for different policy changes, which we've seen in some of the more recent lockdown regulations regarding police conduct and the way in which the regulations are criminalized. And we've launched a lot of different applications to get people who have been detained unlawfully released during the lockdown.
Can you please tell us, give us an idea of some of the complaints? What have they been highlighting? What has the police done, according to citizens who have phoned you on this line?
So it's a wide range of alleged abuses. Some of it that's been well documented and shown on the news. Police beating up people who were allegedly violating the regulations, people that they saw outside, particularly in your less affluent neighborhoods, police shooting rubber bullets at citizens who are simply trying to go shopping, arresting individuals who are trying to get food, or shutting down spaza shops or all sorts of types of smaller shops that are not, and taking away people's income. Everything, and when we say police, we mean all law enforcement that has been active during the lockdown, all the way from the army. Your more gross examples, obviously, are police killing individuals like Colin Khoza, but he's not the only individual who's been killed. At least a dozen individuals have been killed.
Look, now, race is, of course, an issue in South Africa. It continues to be an issue in South Africa. Can we say the police system, or rather can we say police brutality, essentially is a problem within black and colored communities only?
So, no. I think a better statement is to say issues of police brutality disproportionately affect the black and colored communities, less affluent communities. So I think our policing is still very classist, and by the nature of South Africa, very racist. There's different manner in which police interact with certain neighborhoods, and obviously your more affluent neighborhoods are normally where have a higher population of individuals who are not black or colored. And I think the manner in which the police interact with certain communities, your poorer black colored neighborhoods, is akin to the same strategies that were used in policing during apartheid. And those tactics have not really evolved. And that difference is very clear.
Okay. And now when we understand, or when we want to look at IPED now, right? I mean, do you think that IPED is equipped to effectively deal with the police situation? Do they have the resources to investigate and prosecute?
So, I think that's a difficult question. I don't think that the IPED budget comes anywhere close enough to be able to deal with the kind of magnitude of complaints that they get in a specific year. And that forces them to prioritize different cases. And it means that not all complaints that they get receive the attention that those complaints should. And it's not necessarily an issue of an unwillingness from IPED, but just a lack of capacity. But also, a lot of these complaints should be getting dealt with within this same police stations by station commanders, by provincial commissioners. And so to relegate our system towards all police accountability to come through IPED already sets us up for failure. And so I think if you look at it holistically, IPED definitely are not doing enough and they're under-resourced, but the two are correlated. I think they do still serve an important function, and the cases that they do prioritize, I still think individuals get justice, but the magnitude of complaints and the cases that receive enough attention is just too wide.
Okay. And do you think that the police brutality has increased during lockdown? What have you guys seen? Because you've had this line as well, the open line for citizens.
So I think it's difficult to say yes immediately. Definitely at the inception of the lockdown, before there were some amendments to the regulations, before the Colin Causer case, before we, us and a number of organizations pushed for certain policy guidelines in the way in which police were operating, definitely there was a massive spike in law enforcement brutality, a lot more of it coming from members of the military and defense force. I think the attention that was put on the conduct of them, the reaction from our judiciary, and the reaction from civil society, and the action from the executive, means that those guidelines have seen a reduction in the kind of more egregious acts of brutality that we're seeing before. But on a whole, you'd need someone to do some significant research to really compare that. And so I can't give you a straight answer on that.
Mm-hmm. And as lawyers for human rights, I mean, in terms of citizens feeling empowered, you know, when you are a victim of police brutality and you feel that IPED is not giving you the recourse you need, what can you do?
So there are a number of organizations such as ours who try and help citizens with situations like that. I think wherever you're not, the state as a whole is not living up to your rights, obviously the best thing to do is seek legal advice. And for the problem, obviously, is access to justice and access to legal representation is normally expensive and normally something that's only accessible to people who are rich. And that's where we try and bridge that gap. And so I would say try and call Lawyers for Human Rights. Try call another NGO who work in the space. Try and approach the public protector, the Human Rights Commission, and try and see if one of those Chapter 9 institutions cannot take your matter further if you can't get a private attorney.
And how does one contact Lawyers for Human Rights?
So we are on Facebook, we are on Twitter, we have 6 offices across the country, we have a website, and our information is available. You can contact us depending on which geographical area you are. You can just look for any of our numbers, Durban.
Let's share the website. Let's share the website. That would have all the information.
Yes, so that's lhr.org.za.
lhr.org.za for the Lawyers for Human Rights. And, you know, I just want to wrap off now by asking you around the police bigwigs and politicians. You know, I mean, when it comes to protecting citizens' rights, they should surely be stepping up a lot more. They should be more vocal. They should be out there really ensuring that people's faith in the police is restored. Now, how do you think they may actually be enabling this kind of behavior? I mean, we've seen in 2009 the police minister saying that the police should be out, 2019, sorry, that the police, yeah, wait, back in 2009, the police minister saying, you know, the police should shoot to kill. And that's the kind of statements that make the police, or that make people think, you know, the police are empowered by politicians and the bigwigs. I mean, even going as far as high up to as to the minister.
Yes, and I think it's that sort of culture that treats citizens as criminals, and that forgoes the due process that is in our Constitution and in the Criminal Procedure Act, that gives the police the impression that they're above the law when they're not. And definitely the rhetoric of certain police ministers, certain people in the executive, and certain politicians in different political parties has been deplorable and led to the situation. An example, obviously, is what we've seen recently in Cape Town with some of the comments by the mayor of Cape Town and the manner in which the city's law enforcement have been treating citizens looking for housing. And there is a direct correlation between the speech and the policies of politicians and the way in which our law enforcement essentially break the law. And it is one of the things we're trying to do in holding those politicians a lot more accountable. And likely enough, we have Chapter 9 institutions who are empowered to do that and who recently have been taking up their constitutional powers to hold those ministers accountable. But last year, the Deputy Minister of Police had to issue an apology for some of his more hateful comments that he gave around the individual who live in Hillborough. And so that is something that we have to keep a watch on. And definitely politicians should do better, because their words have meaning and action.
Mm-hmm. Look, I just quickly want to share a feedback that has come through from a listener, because I think this is something that Lawyers for Human Rights might be able to pick up on. Now, listener 5713 has sent through quite a lengthy message. Let me get through it. She says, my husband was killed by the police on the 2nd of August 2020. That is this year. That is last month. He was then taken to the mortuary, and nowhere on the news was this mentioned. I only found my husband 6 days after he was taken to the mortuary. I have called numerous parts of the state to understand what happened and found that his case is with IPED. I need to know how I can get information, as I have absolutely no idea what really happened and how he died. I need help because IPED is now becoming frustrated with me, as I call daily to know what time I am to meet them. I then get an excuse that they are too busy, or this or that or the other. I'm broken and stressed with the fact that I'm alone with my two kids, and my health is busy taking a knock because this whole thing of him being killed by the police is making me cry. I have questions. How? Why would they kill him? He could have still been alive. Did they make him a cold case? I'm a sad, lonely wife in need of answers for a husband who is no longer alive, killed by the police. Can I have a contact number of someone higher in IPED? So this person sent the message while listening to this radio program, not getting any help with IPED. You have said that people could contact you. Can I pass on the details so that this listener may contact Lawyers for Human Rights?
Yes, definitely.
Shall I give her your number?
Yes.
Okay. Listener, I'm going to send you now via WhatsApp the number for this person from. He's the Acting Deputy Director of Lawyers for Human Rights, and you can call him and they'll be able to assist you in your query. Wayne, anything else to add before we wrap up?
No, I think we've covered everything. I think it's important that citizens hold the police accountable and remember that they work for us and do not lord over us. So they should also be held accountable for their actions.
Okay. That there is Wayne, the Acting Deputy Director for Lawyers for Human Rights. Thank you so much for joining us this evening on Burning Issue.
So thank you very much. Bye.
Well, now I'm going to wrap up the show. I would like to thank our listeners for being participating, for participating rather in the show. Shukran so much for sending us your questions and your feedback. I can see there are no calls and, we've interviewed all our guests. It's been quite a heated debate this evening with IPED and of course, IPED being very defensive about their situation. And I guess rightfully so, everybody's going to defend their turf and their work. We've also spoken to researchers, we've spoken to community activists, and of course Lawyers for Human Rights telling us exactly how they play a role in helping citizens find justice when the police allegedly acted illegally towards them. So that's the show for tonight from myself, Yazid Kamaldin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Issue.